I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
I'm Erica Wise, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Cutting the Curd is produced by Heritage Radio Network, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station devoted to all things food. Help keep HRN alive by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate. Do it now or else. We mentioned Daphne Zeppos a lot on this show, most recently on our episode with Jason Hines of the Neal's Yard Dairy about effective cheesemongering. For those of you who don't know who Daphne Zeppos was, Daphne was an outspoken advocate for artisan and traditional cheese production and spread her cheese gospel through the American Cheese Society, at Slow Food's biannual festival, Cheese and Brah, and in courses throughout the world, including the Cheese School of San Francisco, Neal's Yard Dairy in London, and Zingerman's in Ann Arbor. She made a lasting impact on the profession of cheesemongering in the U.S. and worldwide. I was fortunate enough to say Daphne was one of my mentors in this business. She picked me up when I was down, took a chance on me when no one else would, actually. I was between work, and she picked me up and got me a job at the Essex Cheese Company. I was their first employee, and it was really, really a difficult and challenging experience, and it tested the bonds of our friendship. I was lucky enough to call her my friend, and she taught me a lot, you know. She was a mentor, I think, to a lot of people, and it was a shame to lose her. Unfortunately, Daphne passed away in 2012, but like the visionary she was, Daphne conceived of a scholarship fund dedicated to educating future leaders of the American cheese industry. This scholarship is the Daphne Zeppos Teaching Award, known simply as the DZTA, and it awards recipients $5,000 to travel through Europe to immerse themselves in cheese learning, and then come back and share their newfound knowledge at the American Cheese Society's annual conference. Welcome to Cutting the Curd. As always, this is your host, Greg Blaze, and today we're interviewing two winners of the DZTA, Tom Perry, the 2015 award recipient, and cheesemonger at Potash Market. He's on the line with us from Chicago. Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
Hey.
Yeah.
Hey, what's up, buddy? How you doing? Good to have you. And then I have Sam Frank in the studio with me, this year's DZTA recipient and prior guest of Cutting the Curd, and an affineur at Crown Finish Caves right here in Brooklyn. Congrats and welcome back to the show, Sam.
Thank you very much, Greg. Great to be here.
Awesome. The DZTA episode is becoming one of our annual traditions, so if you want to hear more about previous winners, check out episodes 146 with Jess Perry and episode 233 with Emily Sharton and Tom Perry before he headed out in his scholarship travels. So I'd like to start out by asking you, Tom, how did your ACS presentation go?
As far as I know, it went pretty well. I haven't gotten any official feedback, but everybody that was in attendance said that it was pretty well received, and people were really digging it. I had a lot of people come up to me afterwards asking me for the written version of the presentation because there was a lot of dense knowledge being dropped that session. So,
awesome.
Yeah. I was there for it, and I would definitely say that it exceeded, personally, my expectations. It was a pretty landmark presentation, and I don't think there's really been anything like it that's preceded it at the American Cheese Society.
That's awesome. For those of our listeners who missed your ACS presentation or our last DZTA episode, remind us again of your research topic, Tom.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
So for any of our listeners that that weren't at the ACS or didn't hear our last episode with you, could you tell us what your research topic was?
Oh, sure. Sorry about that.
No, you're good.
So basically my original vision was to investigate cultures or countries that had developed or investigated their native starter cultures, particularly Switzerland, France, and to a degree the UK. Well, the UK, but the ones that really have done a lot of investigation were Switzerland and France, and then how we could use those methods to develop our own native starter cultures. Kind of basing it off of like the whole terroir notion that the microbes that you have closer to home are going to play better with the microbes that are found naturally within your milk. So I went to Switzerland, France, and England, and got to talk with some really amazing people, particularly the folks at Agriscope that do all of the cultures for Swiss Association cheeses. And also I visited a research station of INRA, which is one of the French research facilities, particularly the one in Poligny, where they do a lot of research with Comte and Lorbier. And then in the UK, I also got to speak with the team at Barbers, who are the ones that have propagated and sourced most of the cultures being used by artisan producers in England right now.
Awesome. What was the highlight for you?
There are a number of highlights. First of all, I started the whole research project not long after we talked.
Uh-huh.
I went to go visit with like Andy Hatch,
yeah,
and Willie Lehner up in Wisconsin, and I was also able to make a couple of trips to Danisco and Chris Hansen, that also have facilities in Wisconsin. So I was able to speak with those scientists, even though they didn't let me record them. They introduced a lot of knowledge that I didn't have before. And then after that, it was like probably about 6 months of just hardcore reading, like Cheese and Microbes, that was edited by Kathy Donnelly. And then when the Broadwin book, as I like to call it, or the raw milk microbiology book came out, I devoured that, along with a lot of academic papers that were made available to me online through various folks that were like, oh, you should read this. And then once I actually started the trip, I went to Vermont and spent time with Sister Noella. The loudest, which was awesome. And you know, she was just so generous with her time. She was like, you know, I've got nothing to hide. It's been on film twice now. So that was outstanding. Going up to Parashil Creamery in West Westminster and talking with Peter Dixon and Rachel Shawl about how they're sourcing their cultures by making their own, essentially. And then from there, going up to Jasper Hill, which are going like the opposite direction, and you know, as opposed to where Peter and Rachel are, like, you know, these are cultures, we don't necessarily know what's in them, but they make the cheese that we're very happy with. And Jasper Hill is they have their own staff microbiologist Thayer, who
Amazing.
Has been working with Ben Wolf and Dr. Dutton, Rachel Dutton, to track down microbes that are unique to their land, their facilities, their animals, and their milk, which is pretty cool in its own right that, you know, there's somebody taking that step right now.
Yeah, that's great. Did you find that people were more or less forthcoming with all of that information than you originally thought they would be?
Especially folks in Europe were a lot more forthcoming with the information than I thought they would be. And even at Jasper Hill, you know, they were very, very open about what their ends were,
yeah,
and how they were trying to achieve it. I don't think that, you know, it's necessarily public knowledge, but they were happy to share the information, and I was happy to, you know, share what you know, their methodology was, if not, you know, not the exact findings. And I thought when I went to go visit the Agroscope or Barbers or INRA, like, it would just be like, you can't record us, you can't, you know, ask us these questions, we don't want to talk to it. They're like, oh, ask us whatever you want. And they let me record them as well, which was amazing because...
You weren't expecting
really
that at all.
Overcoming some of the accents and stuff.
Sure.
And not losing something in translation.
Yeah. Were you, could you just explain for our listeners what those facilities or what those places are, as you know, what they do in terms of your project? The Barbers.
Do you mean like INRA and Agriscope?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So Agriscope is like a federal research institution in Switzerland that was set up in the mid-1800s. It was initially designed to study viticulture and wheat, as a lot of these initial like agricultural science outposts in Europe were meant to do. It was a way to improve output and also to study what was, you know, important to them from a cultural perspective. And then by around the turn of the, you know, century and going into the 20th century, especially after the acceptance of germ theory and, you know, better understanding of like a microbial world, there was a lot of research that really started getting pushed towards, especially the dairy sciences. So Agroscope, particularly the station at Leedfield, which is just outside of Barron, they were very instrumental, particularly like Dr. Edward von Freudenreich and Dr. Jensen. They helped really tamp down a lot of the thermophiles that we use in cheese making today. And this was in Switzerland around the turn of the century, World War One era. And then INRA was in a similar position, but they were disrupted by a couple of world wars. But they made serious strides towards improving and sustaining their own agricultural setups. And then in the 70s is when they really started adding microbiological labs into the mix, tracking down what made their cheeses tick, so to speak.
Cool. And as they were forthcoming, did that change the scope of your project for you at all? As you started to visit and do more research and talk to those guys, did that change what you thought was possible for your research for your own project?
Well, I mean, what it did was it kind of opened my eyes. So the conclusion that I came to was the majority of the major acidifying properties that we use for, or microbes that we use for cheese, have been found. But there are sub-strains, and there's obvious evolution that goes on in the microbial world because you really can't fight it. And basically the strains that we're using now are kind of what I'm referring to as like frozen snapshots in time of acidifiers. Like we have these dominant strains that are being propagated and used over and over and over again. And that has its own concerns, but you know, so far it's been safe. And the reason that they're buying and researching still is because primarily it's to prevent against bacteriophage, but, you know, it also keeps the gene pool robust and allows for, you know, a bit more safety on these ends. So, I mean, basically anything that we do find right now in terms of its major uses is going to be substrains of the major lactic acid bacteria that we're using now, and as well as adjuncts and molds and yeast that are part of the microbial makeup.
Cool. Hey, Sam, well, I always want to keep the gene pool robust. That is a good thing to do on all levels.
Always.
As a cheesemaker and a cheese affineur, do you find Tom's research – you must find – and you said that was a landmark presentation at the ACS, so that must just be amazing news to you.
Absolutely. I mean, Tom's whole project is essentially trying to build on this notion of American terroir, our own taste of place.
Yeah.
And there's been so much efforts have been made, you know, as the American artisan cheese industry has continued to grow, to producing better quality milk that is more of an expression of the landscape. But then when you are propagating this milk with these commercially produced cultures that come from, you know, the amount of culture producing companies you can count on one hand, like it's a very, very undiverse gene pool there. And it's also replacing the native microflora in the milk, which is a true expression of that landscape, with these cultures that are found and that have been isolated by these labs. So to me, it's very exciting to even just start this conversation and to see where it goes as the American artisan cheese industry continues to grow.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, and welcome back to the show, Sam.
Thank you.
Super happy to have you here. Our listeners may remember you were also on our show before, episode 209, all about cheese research and development with Crown Finish Caves and Sugar House Creamery. It's great to have you back. And your project is related to dairy cows, correct?
Yes. Well, my original vision was just about dairy cows, but I might be branching out into sheep and goats as well.
Nice.
Yeah. And so, yeah, when I wrote my vision, I gave a shout out to Tom because, like I said, his whole project is trying to build on this notion of American terroir. And so I was inspired by that to pursue something I've been interested in a long time, which is native American heritage breed animals.
Excellent.
Which is something that is not, there's not a lot of information out there about these animals. These are breeds of cows that, like such as the American Milking Devon, the Randall Lineback, the Canadian, the Milking Shorthorn. These are all very old breeds that are native to North America that today are critically endangered of extinction. So there's little efforts being made to repopulate our dairy farms with these traditional dairy breeds because, you know, the United States went the way of conventional agriculture.
Yep.
I mean, we invented it. And so dairy farming is no different in that regard. So, you know, when most people close their eyes and picture a cow, they see a black and white spotted animal.
Sure.
And that's the Holstein cow. That's just one breed of cow.
The milk machine.
The milk machine, bred to produce milk.
Yeah.
More than any other breed, which is great. And, you know, and I also just want to make it clear that, like, I am not a dairy farmer. I do not know everything about the business of dairy farming, and I have nothing against people that are milking Holstein cows.
Well, that's good, because, you know, there were a bunch of guys lined up outside of here.
I know, yeah.
Which waiting to end you if
Bushwick
you had said
enough. Bushwick is filled with dairy farmers.
They're right outside the window. But that being said, where are you going to travel, or what are you going to do to, you know, to further your research to keep these breeds going?
So, yeah, so my whole idea is to look at Europe as a model, because there's a lot of regions of Europe where they're still milking their traditional breeds that they've been milking for hundreds of years to make their traditional cheeses. And even though, you know, in the last couple centuries, we have these more modern conventional breeds that can produce more milk than their own traditional breeds, but
right.
Yet they continue to use these old breeds. So in my original vision, I proposed going to Normandy,
sure.
On the coast of France, to look at the Normandy cattle, where, you know, cheeses such as Camembert and Pont-l'Evêque have been made from their milk for centuries.
Decent butter, too.
Not bad butter.
Caramels also.
Yeah, everything day. And then I also wanted to look at the Salers breed.
Oh, sure.
In Auvergne, which traditionally they make Salers cheese. And
that's a cheese that's almost extinct,
right? That's right. And real Saint-Nectaire as well,
yeah.
Which has traditionally been made from their milk.
Sure.
And that cow in particular, though I at this point don't know much about them, they're incredibly rustic animals, very old world breed that, in fact, even to milk them, they first have to let the calf suckle the mom's teat before she will actually let her milk down for the humans
wow.
to take to make
nice.
Into cheese. So it's like, I mean, I can't imagine how incredibly long and hard of a process just one of the two daily milkings
sure,
is
sure.
to get enough milk to make cheese.
That's some coordination. That's a little bit of logistics.
Quite a bit. I watched a video one time, and it was just showing them milking one of the cows, and that entire process took at least like 7 or 8 minutes, and this was like a herd of 50 cows.
Right.
So that was another one. Another breed was the Tarentaise.
Oh, sure.
In the French Alps, yeah, which has traditionally been used for Beaufort, yeah, Abondance, some Reblochon. And
all cheeses that are fleeting.
Yes. And these cows are very genetically unique because they've been isolated in, you know, that particular part of the French Alps for so long that they are very well bred for that, you know, particular region of the world. And then next I wanted to go into Italy a little bit, and I was actually hoping to talk to you more in the future, Greg, about this, because I wanted to look at the Vacca Rossa,
sure,
the famous red cow of Emilia-Romagna that Parmigiano Reggiano traditionally was always made from.
Almost disappeared. I mean, they were down to like three-digit numbers, I think, in cows at one point. You know,
which I will say, all of the American breeds I noted, they are all in the three digits. Yeah. There's only a couple hundred of each of those breeds. And the red cow, I think, is a particularly interesting case because they've essentially built this brand of Parmigiano Reggiano around this breed of cow.
And it's good cheese, man.
Yeah, I mean, and it's great. It's an excellent cheese. And I think, you know, in a place like the United States where we are all about branding and marketing, that this is actually kind of a pretty interesting approach that perhaps could be mimicked here. Is like, how do we build a brand around an animal as opposed to, you know, a cheesemaker?
We're going to brand Cutting the Curd. I'm going to have some Cutting the Curd thongs made up. It's
awesome.
Going to be some temporary tattoos. You
great,
know?
Great. Everyone loves a good temp tat.
No, but seriously, yeah, I would love to talk to you about that in the future. And so, Tom, how do you plan to keep teaching this, you know, what you've learned on your trip, even now that your ACS presentation, you know, is over?
So I'll probably end up doing the fancy food circuit. Hoping to do it in San Francisco, New York, as we get closer to that one. Obviously, I'd like to present it here in Chicago to our little cheese group that we've got going on sooner than that. And pretty much anywhere else that would have me, so to speak. Already thinking about also what I'm going to be investigating, hopefully, for next year, for next year's ACS. And just kind of building upon this notion of developing our own cultures, or more importantly, how important our own native microbes are to the cheese that we're producing.
Fantastic. As a follow-up to that, Sam, who is going to be your target audience to further what you're going to learn in your trip?
As far as like who do I want to reach with what I'm... I mean, cheesemakers and dairy farmers. You know, I've talked to just a small handful at this point and about my idea and have had a mix of reviews. I mean, some people think it's, you know, very important work that needs to be done and needs to be investigated. But, you know, there's also realistic individuals out there that say, you know, if you are trying to run a business, you know, it's all about numbers. And, you know, a Holstein cow and Jersey cows, like we know that they can produce milk and you can produce cheese from their milk. But there's a lot of skepticism around these other traditional old world breeds that do not produce similar insane volumes of milk. So,
but the truth is always somewhere closer to the middle. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And you need to do the work. You know what I mean? These animals were around. It's not like they became obsolete.
Right.
You know
exactly.
I mean? So the truth's in the middle somewhere.
Yeah. And ideally, you know, I will reach some dairy farmers and cheesemakers out there and we'll get them thinking about it. And even if it's not, you know, converting your entire herd right away to this one of these old breeds, but you know, just thinking more about agricultural biodiversity in general and having a more diversity among your animals' genetics and trying to have different kinds of milk components in your herd. So maybe it just means mixing up your herd or crossbreeding, or you know, I mean, the whole topic of breeds is kind of a vague topic in general, and so maybe we could even start to see new breeds being created over time. And I've even heard of cheesemakers that are trying to develop their own breeds on their farms.
Information is key. And the thing is that you're going to provide people with information to make an accurate choice about where they want to go with their animals.
That's the goal.
We're going to take a little bit of a break, and then we're going to come back and talk to these guys a little bit more.
Music for this commercial break is brought to you by RecTech, and this track is called Dues Paid.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company. The operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirsois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Welcome back to Cutting the Curd. We're talking with Tom Perry and Sam Frank about their Daphne Zeppos Teaching Award projects. For the second part of the episode, I wanted to first ask Tom if he has any advice for Sam as he embarks on his project, or for any of our listeners who want to travel and learn about cheese or perhaps apply for this award.
So it's funny that you say that you ask that, because I must have bombarded Sam with like 3 emails now about stuff that he should, you know, think about or things that might go on while he's on his travels.
Yeah, it's a novella, you could call it.
One thing that I would always suggest, so if you're going to apply for DZTA, which I encourage everybody that really wants to do this to do, but first think that you're probably going to be away from home, work, your family for about a month.
Sounds great.
Learning about cheese, which is awesome. But I mean, while I had some amazing experiences, and I would never, never not do this, there were certain points where it was like really lonely, and just kind of take that into account. I also told Sam, you know, start saving now. Like take $25 out of your paycheck, and sure, you know, just put it in another bank account, and like have that accrue before you travel. Because you know, $5,000 is a great start, but it may not necessarily cover everything. What else would I suggest? Start planning as soon as possible. The thing that's unfortunately a little annoying about receiving the award at the end of July is that all of the people that you want to like reach out to in Europe are on vacation.
Yes, they are. They all are. I have no cheese coming in from Europe right now.
Exactly. So while you're rearing to go and you know, just wanting to like get going as soon as possible, they're on vacation, and it's kind of this radio silence, sure, for about a month. And then it's another month while they're catching up on those emails they missed over August. Be prepared to have extreme jet lag, because you're going to like, sure, get in at I've never had jet lag as bad as I did on this trip, because my schedule was altering so much. I would, you know, be up late one night, and then I'd have to be up at 4:30 the next day to meet up at a cheese dairy, and then
their day starts early, man. You know, I mean, that's
and then you're crossing multiple time zones,
sure,
Also, the language barrier. Prepared to like start your Duolingo or Rosetta Stone learning now. And you know, fortunately, the places I traveled, a lot of people spoke pretty good English. But there were a couple of times when I relied heavily on my high school French, and sure, I'm thankful for it. But you know, just
You're talking like general road warrior-esque, you know, things. But Sam, you're a veteran traveler, right? I mean, you know some of these things, right?
Yeah, I think so.
That's good. That's good advice. I mean, for anybody.
Yeah.
I've done that. I've done that too. You know, I've done the Europe lags where, like, you know, it's 6 a.m. somewhere, but it's not 6 a.m. in your mind.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Luckily, I'm very adaptable to time zones.
Yeah,
I just
that's
need
cool.
one sleep and I'm good to go.
That's awesome. And I used to be that way many, many years ago. Now I need multiple sleeps per day just to make it through. So both of your projects revolve around this idea, and you mentioned it before, of capturing the essence of terroir here in America. Tom through the microbiology of the milk, and Sam through the breeds of dairy cattle used to produce that milk. Could you guys elaborate on the idea of terroir in the U.S. and what you envision the landscape of American cheese will be through the lens of terroir? Maybe, Sam, you can start us off on that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, like I was saying before, there's been a lot of efforts, you know, as this industry has developed to be producing better quality milk that is more of an expression of the landscape and, you know, rotating your cows on pasture and making seasonal cheese. And I think, you know, the more people that are producing grass-based cheese, then the more our terroir is going to develop.
Certainly.
And, you know, especially the United States is such a giant country that, you know, encapsulates every topography and climate. You know, there's lots of different varieties of pastures and non-pastures out there. You know, there's you know, parts of the Southwest where it's, you know, it's kind of maybe similar to parts of Spain, southern France, southern Italy, that are a lot more arid, that are, you know, more suited for different animals, different kinds of cheeses. So yeah, I just think the more that people are tailoring their cheeses to their landscape, the more, you know, the American terroir will continue
and
to
America
grow.
Is amazing like that. We have everything here. We have deserts, we have Arctic territories,
right.
You know what I mean? We have literally everything in between.
Yeah.
So it's all there. Every type of grass, every type of animal, every type of human being somehow can exist here. So
exactly.
Yeah, so the more we use our own stuff, the better off we can, you know, make an expression of our own landscape.
Yeah. And I also think that, you know, I feel like in general, you see a lot with, new cheesemakers that they produce a lot of different varieties of cheese. Which again, I think, you know, from a business standpoint is you're trying to appeal to the widest audience possible.
Certainly.
So some people might like cheddar, some people might like brie, some people might like mozzarella. So you try to kind of do it all. And it seems like you end up kind of trying to imitate a lot of these different European styles and
not always well
and not always well,
sometimes very well,
sometimes incredibly,
sometimes better than the original.
Exactly. What I think would be a really cool thing to see is if more cheesemakers kind of tried to hone in on their product lines. And so instead of creating all these different European styles to try to appeal to this very wide audience, like, you know, develop your own style and stick with that and make that your brand and your product and your image.
What do you think about that, Tom?
Well, I mean, actually, what I was about to say dovetails perfectly with what Sam just said, because, you know, being Americans, we don't have a PDO. We don't have a system like that.
We can do whatever we want.
We have a cultural tradition that we're necessarily falling back on. Like, the thing that is American terroir is our uniqueness, like the uniqueness that we have in all the different cheeses, the American originals. Like, the closest thing that we probably do have to a PDO or a set style of cheese is cheddar.
Sure.
And you know, from, you know, Atlantic to Pacific, you've got your vast different styles of cheddar, your classic New England cheddar, your Wisconsin cheddar, and like your West Coast cheddars, and they've all got their unique stamps. You know, the way microbiology is, like, it's not like you're going to have, like, a general, you know, like you're not going to have this big cloud of, like, you know, lactobacillus, like Helveticus or whatever, hanging over and, like, that will influence the cheese make. No, like, literally every plot of land is going to have its own different microbial makeup. And that's what the real terroir of American cheese is it's everything that we have, and there are new things that we can attain out of it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, and I agree with all that. I mean, I'm the end of the line, you know. I'm just a cheesemonger. I sell the cheese. And I just think that it's fantastic that you guys are doing this kind of work, because it makes my job that much more much more easy and better to do. You know what I mean? And all the information that you have then flows downhill to me, and I can be a better cheesemonger as a result of it. Cool stuff, man. As a final question, both of you guys did the DZTA 5K at the ACS. I can't run anywhere unless someone's chasing me, and even then, I might not make it. What was that experience like? I saw some pictures in social media, and it looked like a great time. Did you have a good time, Sam?
Oh man, it was a fantastic way to end the conference. There was a lot of camaraderie. You know, I mean, this was after the conference was over, so you know, most people had fled Des Moines by that point. So we were like the last stronghold of the American Cheese Society Conference of 2016.
That's
and,
great.
You know, everyone was there. You know, there was not any kind of competitive atmosphere at all. Everyone was just there to have a good time and there to support DZTA and to just kind of see each other off in a positive atmosphere.
Awesome.
Totally.
You had a good one, too. Obviously, you both made it.
Yes.
Because you're both.
We both crossed the finish line.
That's fucking great. That's great. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, we finished in last with Anthea Stoltz from California Cheese Guild and Tamara Bacon, who's at Boxcar for the summer.
Awesome.
So it was a nice leisurely run for me.
That's so great. Well, I want to thank you both for coming on the show, and congratulations to both of you again. I'm looking forward to having you on again next year, Sam, to talk about your experience and travels. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you want to learn more about the Daphne Zeppos Teaching Award or you want to donate, visit DaphneZepposTeachingAward.org. Stay tuned next week for a recap of the American Cheese Society Conference featuring Best of Show winners with Diane Stemple. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.